Hey everyone, welcome back. Welcome back to the Letters and Layers podcast, where I talk all things mental health, wellness, life lessons, books, personal insights, and everything in between. Welcome to any new listeners. Thank you for joining me. This is your host, Amaka. It is Monday, September 15th when I'm recording, so you're catching me as close to real time as possible. I was excited to record this episode because if you remember two episodes back, I did a review on Dream Count by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And I wanted to do it in two parts because I kind of wanted to give a general impression and overview. And then I wanted to highlight a couple of quotes and excerpts from the book that really stuck with me or that, you know, made an impression on me. I tend to be the type of person who, you know, just really enjoys how people, authors, whoever, use words, you know, and string them together to put certain sentences, construct sentences, you know, make you think of things in ways you've never thought about them before. The way you can just convey humor and conviction and, you know, just so many things. So I do oftentimes have like favorite sentences in books. Like if you listen to my Thicker Than Water episode about Kerry Washington's book, I had a couple of favorite sentences from that book. She's actually a really good writer, in my opinion. So just wanted to use this episode to kind of highlight some of my favorite quotes and excerpts. Some of them because they made me think of things in a new way. Some of them because they made me chuckle. Some of them, they made me like laugh out loud. Some of them, they made me just, it was interesting how with one particular excerpt, I could relate to it on a personal level because it had happened to me in my life. So we're going to get into all of it. I have four quotes/excerpts that I want to highlight in this episode. The first one being on page 54. So I'm going to make my way to that page right now. So page 54, we are in the first installment of the book, which is Chiamaka. And we are kind of in the throes of her very toxic and unfortunate dynamic with Darnell. And while I was reading, you know, this part of the book up to this point, I was just really, I had so many feelings. I had a lot of feelings. I was upset with Chiamaka. I felt sorry for her. I was disappointed. I just couldn't understand why she would let herself, why she would allow herself, you know, be in this situation with this man who clearly did not regard her and respect her and was stringing her along and did not regard her feelings, in my opinion. So while I was reading, I was like, girl, you're better than this. Girl, you can't see what he's doing. Like, are you so blinded by whatever love or attachment you're feeling that you can't see what he's doing to you? And, you know, I was trying to find a reason, a point of empathy that I could grasp onto. Because, you know, women do find themselves in situations where they are attached to a man that's not good for them. Oftentimes it's because maybe they don't have an example of a decent, well-rounded male figure in their life, be it a father, grandfather, uncle, whoever. So, you know, in the quest of looking for love, though it may not be from the right place, they could, you know, settle for what they don't deserve. So this excerpt on page 54, I was like, finally, finally, because it sounded as though with this excerpt, she was kind of looking back and wondering how could she have allowed herself to go through all this. So I will go ahead and read it. I wasn't sure what he meant, but I agreed and felt chastised. I would have delighted in Darnell's jealousy, but it wasn't jealousy because he knew I was blind to everything but him. It was control, a rationing of what I was allowed. He squashed my smallest pleasures, and I helped him flatten them, sinking myself into the mean crevices of his will. I look back now and see my weakness in such sharp relief, being pliant and docile in exchange for nothing. The clarity of hindsight is bewildering. If only we could see our failings while we are still failing. So I underlined that whole paragraph and then I double underlined the last sentence because I was like, girl, yes, I can see everything that's going on as a third party reading your life in this book, but you can't see what's happening. So I just felt like, yeah, if only we could realize mid-fail how bad things were getting. And we do get to that point. Everyone has their own rock bottom. Chiamaka definitely got to her own rock bottom. And eventually they were no longer together and she left him. But yeah, I was like, I don't know where you are or at what point you're in your life to where you're looking in hindsight, but I wish as the reader that it didn't take so long for her to get there and for her to have these realizations. And this is true. This can be true in real life. You know, no one is perfect. I'm not perfect. I'm sure that there have been decisions I've made that maybe have lengthen the amount of time that I was in a situation or had to deal with something maybe much longer than I needed to. It might not necessarily be like a relationship, but just, you know, sometimes out of fear or uncertainty, we hold on to things that we know don't serve us. So it's easy to point the finger at somebody else and say, girl, what are you doing? You can't see what's happening. It's so easy to feel that way towards Chiamaka, especially as a fictional character. But I just felt such relief for her when she realized, you know, why was she putting herself through this? Clearly, this man does not regard her. And there's no reason why she can't have better. So when I read that, I was like, even though she, you know, moving beyond this excerpt, she was still having interactions with him for quite a while. But it was just relieving for me to see that she got to a point eventually where she realized this was a waste of her time, complete and total waste of her time. So the next quote that I wanted to highlight is actually just a few pages later on page 58. This quote, it's a little long, it's about half the page, but this made me laugh and this made me just think about how we're raised. Let me just speak specifically within Nigerian culture and just as a girl that grew up in a Nigerian household, first child, first daughter. You grow up thinking that there are so many rules you have to follow. There's only one way to live. There's only one right way to live. And what your parents are telling you in that moment as you're growing up will feel like it is the word. It is God's word. Like there's no going around it. There's no negotiating There's no alternative to whatever your parents or your family are telling you. And I'm thinking specifically around the topic of marriage and kids. Growing up, I very much got the message that you grow up, you marry an Igbo man. We want our family to retain, you know, our culture, which I understand, that's very important. But I got the message that I had no option but to marry Nigerian. And even more specific than that, I had to marry an Igbo man. And you were crazy if you thought kids were optional. What are you talking about? You've lost your mind. But let's say 20 years later now, let's say I'm in my teens. I've internalized these messages long before my teens, but let's just say now 20 years after the fact, being 36 now, and my sister being in her early 30s, I just find it so funny how the restrictions are just not there anymore and the stipulations have ceased. And it's really family and older extended family like bargaining with you. Let me just read the excerpt and then I will, you know, expound on it. So this is on page 54. And we are, I believe we're still in Chiamaka. Are we? Let me just check quickly. Yes. Yes, we're still in Chiamaka. Okay. Page 54, first full paragraph. The stipulations from my mother and my aunts, maternal and paternal, had started in my mid-20s, firm and fine-edged, and repeated often. He must be Catholic and Igbo, have a university degree, and be able to maintain you. Maintain you, always said in English. Such a strange expression, as though you were a machine needing frequent oiling. In my mid-30s, the conditions began to wilt at the edges. My life, by then, rooted in America. A Christian was fine, of any denomination, a Nigerian of any ethnicity, or an African, or just a black man, or, well, a man. Now, in my mid-40s, with my female eggs in an unforgiving rush to uselessness, marriage had become secondary. Have a child, by whatever means. My mother, on Christmas Day, had said while looking at the nativity scene set out for the village children, "A child is more important than marriage." How slippery moralities are, how they circle and thin and change with circumstance. Imagine if I had decided to have a baby 10 years ago without a husband. Imagine my mother's exploding horror. I reacted pretty viscerally to that because I have extended family that have actually said they were going to encourage my siblings to have kids. Marriage, whether you marry or not, is fine. It's not obligatory anymore. And I was like, when I heard that, I was like, wow, what happened to everything you told us while we were growing up? What happened to, he must be Igbo, he must be Nigerian, or they must be Igbo, they must be Nigerian, you know, because I have brothers and sisters. What happened to all the rules and regulations that you placed upon us? It must have been with the expectation that things were going to go how they thought they were going to go. They probably thought, you know, we would go to college, get our bachelor's, randomly or magically meet our spouse, get married, and start popping out kids. Let me tell you, that's not how it happened. I met my husband in college, but we didn't get married until we were 30, and there was so much life that was lived between the two of us that it only made sense to get married when we did. And even then, we're still marching to the beat of our own drum. You know, we are adhering to our own timelines. And it's just so funny how, like, the more time goes by, the people that thought that they had, like, control over your life choices start to realize that that's not nearly the case. And they start to kind of bargain with you. Okay, just have one kid. Maybe, you know, when you're younger, they're like, oh, yeah, you have to have a big family. What do you mean you're only having three children? What do you mean you only want to have two kids? You're only starting if you have two kids. What are you talking about? But now it's like, just have one kid. Just have one baby. Please. Oh my God. I just find the evolution of all these, you know, kind of seemingly concrete cultural rules and ways of living. They feel like they cannot be negotiated, you know, while you're growing up. And they're made to feel that way because the elders, the family, the parents want you to feel like there's only one way to grow up and live your life. But then you get out on your own and you see that things don't often work out that way. And time passes. And now they're just like, you know, you don't even need to get married. You don't even need to get married. Just have a kid. Just have a kid. Kids are more important than marriage, according to Chiamaka's mom. So I read that and I was like, wow. So this really happens. This really happens. I was floored when I heard about what happened with, like, my extended family, what they were, you know, thinking of telling my siblings. And then reading that, I was like, oh, so this is actually a thing, especially like with me growing up and just being beat over the head with the message of it must be a Nigerian man. I'm just glad I kind of broke out of that early. Like, I realized in my early 20s, like, why would I limit my chance of finding a partner that I love and I'm happy with? Why would I limit that to ethnicity? And I disavowed myself of that way of thinking, and thankfully am in a partnership that I'm very happy with. So I just find it so interesting how the people around you, especially when you're younger, really try to mold and shape the direction that you're going to go, but it often does not work out that way. And when they see what's happening, they, at the end of the day, just try to get what they can. Because in reality, there was no control to be had, you know? And I just find it, I don't even really know what more to say about it. I just think it's a very, very interesting phenomenon, you know? So just reading that and then knowing that this has actually happened in my family, I was like, oh, wow. Okay. Well, I hope, I'm pretty sure that's not going to be me, you know, when it comes to my time with my kids. I'm not going to put those type of limitations on them because I don't even know the type of world they're going to grow up in. And I can only prepare them the best that I can. But yeah, I had to share that excerpt because I couldn't believe how much I related to it. So the third one is, so I've been going in order as far as page number. The third one is actually towards the end of the book. And then the fourth one, we're going to kind of flip earlier in the book. So the third one is on page 359. We're back in Chiamaka, her story at this point in the book. And this quote just made me laugh. So I was like, why not share it? We are in the second half of the page, about five lines down.
In bed, I faked orgasms, but happily. They weren't coming, and so I pretended they did, because I was sure that one day they would. How could they not, with this charismatic man, head nestled between my legs, and arms raised above his head, as though in ever-patient crucifixion? I'm like, Chimamanda, what is wrong with you? There were certain like quotes and excerpts in this book that made me laugh out loud, and this was definitely one of them. I thought it was just so funny, just the imagery that she depicts, and the fact that like she wasn't enjoying the sex with the man to the extent that she could, but because she liked him and because he was trying, you know, and she felt that she could eventually get there, that she should just kind of hold on and you know, hope for the best. And I was like, how many women have found themselves in this position, you know, where they're holding on because of the potential and, you know, what they know could be true, but have not really experienced any real evidence of that being the case. And I feel like Chiamaka found herself in this position of a couple of times, just giving too much of the benefit of the doubt to men that she was dealing with. With Chuka, she broke it off with him, which I was proud of her for. Because he seemed like the perfect, on the outside, he seemed like the perfect Igbo partner to marry. And everyone was like, what are you waiting for? You know, make it official. But she saw glimpses of him privately that raised a bunch of red flags. And then, you know, Darnell is just a whole other story. But yeah, I thought this was hilarious. And I thought it was just one example of how she probably gave this man and other men too many chances. And it probably wasted a lot of her time. But I don't fault her, because a lot of women find themselves in this position for one reason or another. And all you can do is like learn from it. Learn from it and hopefully make better decisions in the future. So I thought I would share. Lastly, this quote is short. It's the shortest one out of all that I've shared so far. And it's in Kadiatu's story. It's on page 209. And it's the first sentence of chapter 8 in Kadiatu's story. Chimamanda writes, "The day that changed her life began in an ordinary way, as most extraordinary days do." I read that sentence and I was like, it's such a simple idea, but for me, just holds so much meaning and depth, because Chapter 8, that first sentence, she is now venturing into telling the story of Kadiatu's sexual assault and just how there is no way Kadiatu could have anticipated what was going to happen to her when she woke up that day. And I think it's such a simple sentence, but I'm just like, yeah, like so many monumental things that happen in our lives, whether it's for better or worse, we wake up that day not knowing what awaits us. Some things we're able to anticipate, you know, some things we plan for, some things work out how we expect, but many times, the experiences that alter us for a lifetime or take us a very long time to heal from or move past, those days start like any other day. this brings me back to the story I shared earlier in the year when I went on a trip to California. You know, I woke up like it was any other day. It wasn't really any other day because I was out of town. I was in a hotel. I was there for a retreat with other Black women. But I woke up and started my day like I would have wanted to any other day. And then the day ended with me reeling and processing the burglary that had happened and the intruder that had entered my hotel room. So it was interesting to read that sentence and have it apply to me in such a real way and kind of have that connection with Karia too, because it was a negative experience, to say the least. I guess in a situation like that, the end result was the best case scenario because my jewelry was stolen and it was recovered. I was not hurt. I had no interaction with the intruder. I was, you know, the staff at the hotel was swift and responsive to what had happened. They had paid attention and made the necessary steps to ensure that I was safe and secure for the rest of my stay. So as far as these situations go, it was the best case scenario for me. And as far as Kadiatu is concerned, the best case scenario for her would have been that sexual assault had never happened. So this sentence can be applied neutrally. It can be applied in a very positive way. You can wake up and it just be an ordinary day when you wake up and the most amazing thing happens to you that you didn't expect. Or you wake up and it's an ordinary day and it ends with you wondering how something like this could have happened to you. So I remember reading that sentence and was like, it just, you know, I feel like subconsciously we're aware of a lot of things, but then it's brought to our conscious mind in different ways. And sometimes it's through a book and sometimes it's through a sentence as simple as that. And it just makes you think. It just makes you think. This also brings me back to a few years ago when I was in nursing school and a childhood friend of mine passed away from complications with sickle cell disease. And she had been battling it her whole life. She eventually succumbed to the battle. And, you know, she was one of my first childhood friends. We weren't always in contact, but it was always love. You know, she was a writer. She would send me what she was writing to read. She would always encourage me to write. And I remember kind of just writing my feelings around her death and writing something along the lines of, you know, you wake up and move about your day because subconsciously you wake up with the belief and assurance that everyone that you love and means the most, you also woke up to. And I think kind of processing that and writing that down helped me to really process her death. You know, we are not just isolated human beings. Ideally, even if we live alone, we are one being in a community of beings. We are one person in a family, a nuclear family, an extended family, a village, a community. And you mentally can identify all the people, could be dozens, it could be hundreds of folks in that social web that you just subconsciously, you wake up and you're like, you don't even really think about it, but you're like, you go about your day because you just operate under the assumption that everyone you love is also up and also doing what they need to do and living their life. And your social and familial web is still functioning at full capacity. I hope that makes sense. And it's when you realize that that's no longer the case, that that social web is ruptured, that you now have to do the work of repairing. And that can take however long it takes. So writing that sentence helped a lot with processing why I was feeling how I was feeling. And, you know, that kind of came to me also too when reading this sentence. Because there are a lot of things that I don't even know what I'm trying to say right now. Just a sentence like that just is so simple, but it's just so profound because yes, that's how life-changing moments come. That's how days in your life that literally alter the course of everything succeeding, that's how it most often starts, just like an ordinary day. So these were the quotes and excerpts that made the biggest impression on me in this book. And overall, I enjoyed it. Like I said in the first part of my review, I know there were some mixed reviews with this book. People were, you know, comparing it to Americana. I feel like it does this book a disservice because Americana is literally 10 years ago. So much has happened. Chimamanda, to the degree that she shared with the public, has gone through a lot, has lost both her parents, went through COVID as we all did. So it only makes sense that she's in a different place. And maybe it's not a place that so many people connect to, but I think there is a lot to take from this book. And, you know, I'm allowing it the space in the Chimamanda literary universe. I'm allowing it its space to live, as we do with all of her other works. So thank you guys for listening. I appreciate you so much. As always, please share, please recommend this episode or past episodes. If you enjoyed the content, feel free to reach out to me at contact@theLettersAndLayers.com. And yeah, I appreciate you guys so much as always. Thank you for the support. Happy 4th anniversary again to the Letters and Layers podcast. We celebrated that last episode with our throwback, but I don't plan on any other throwbacks for the rest of the year. I anticipate it will be all new content until our winter break in December. So thank you guys again, and I will talk to you in the next one. Bye.